Welcome to the Grace in Common podcast, a podcast with four friends, four theologians from four different countries and three different continents where we talk neo-Calvinism, theology, and culture. My name is Marinus de Jong. I'm a pastor at the Oosterparkkerk in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, an assistant professor at the Neo-Calvinism Research Institute in Utrecht. With me is Corey Brock from the United States, pastor of St. Columbus Free Church in Edinburgh and lecturer at Edinburgh Theological Seminary. James Eglinton, senior lecturer of Reformed Theology at the University of Edinburgh. And Gray Sutanto, who's from Indonesia and teaches at Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Welcome to season 5 of Grace in Common. We're glad you're back. We have been away for a while for various reasons, but are excited to get back for another season of Grace in Common. This season, we look forward to a great many guests from the neo-Calvinist scene, and we plan to dig into some more cultural issues this season. This first episode is special because it is a live recording at the Kuiper Conference in Grand Rapids. The topic of the conference was Stewardship in the Kingdom, Business, Academy, and Society. And since we were the opening plenary, we introduce and discuss the topic of stewardship from a theological perspective.
Thank you, Jordan. Yeah, hi. My name's Corey. Really great to see all of you. Maybe you've listened before, maybe you haven't. We're just really glad to get to spend some time doing this with you today and spend the next couple of days with all the group here. We want to thank the Abraham Kuiper Leadership Fund for supporting us with a grant this past year. And thanks to Jordan, thanks to the Kuiper Conference for having us and hosting us and doing this. So we appreciate it. What we're going to do, we're just going to take 40 minutes to discuss the concept and the main theme of the conference, stewardship. And then we have an hour, so we'll take the back 20 minutes to open the discussion to everybody. And would love to have comments, questions. We'll reflect on those and happy for dialogue between people. So that's the plan for the next hour, and really want to get just the juices flowing on thinking about the concept that we're speaking about for the whole of the conference. And so that's the plan. So I'm just going to open us with a question to you guys. Yeah. So what, from a theological perspective, what is stewardship as a theological concept, and how do you guys see it used in the neo-Calvinist tradition of the past?
Yeah, so I think, well, there's, you can think of, I think, stewardship in different ways. So if you look, if we're all well at home in the New Covenant sources and we look there, you will not find that term. So the word Rentmeester, stewardship, like Kuiper and Bavinck and also Schilder, they don't really use that word. And when they use it, they only apply it to money. Right, because you're a steward of money, and in that way, like be a good steward of the money that has been given to you. So a very specific use of it. That doesn't mean that the concept beneath it is, I think, very characteristic of the whole of neo-Calvinism. We're going to talk about that a little bit more later. So I guess like being steward of money is a very narrow definition of it. But like if we take it broader, it could also talk about like being a steward of creation. I think that's a way in which it's used very often in theology, like man as steward of creation. We could also apply it to being a steward of what has been given to you personally. Like we think, for example, of the parable of the talents in Matthew 25, where Jesus speaks about that. Like, how do you deal with what is given to you with your talents? And yeah, I guess so. These are, I guess, three. Are there any more that could be added to our definition? What do you think?
Yeah, I think the immediate concept that comes to my mind is, of course, who we are as made in God's image. So Genesis 1, 26, 28 is going to be a key text for us because it says that we are made in the image of God. We're also called to be fruitful and to multiply and therefore to represent God. And a lot of biblical studies scholarship has really shown to us that part of what it means to be made in God's image is this vocational aspect. I mean, I don't think it's reducible to that. I think that our Reformed tradition and the Reformed scholastics would argue that the vocational aspect is an important part of it, but we're also made metaphysically in the image of God. We're made to relate to one another in a particular way. But the vocational aspect is definitely clearly there in Genesis 1, 26, 28. You know, in the ancient Near East, we have these statues that represent the dominion of particular gods in different temples in different spaces. And those statues represent that lordship and that local context. And we're told in the Bible not to make images of God, because we are made in the image of God. We are the ones that represent God's dominion on earth. And so that representational work is really key, because we're imaging God in our work. We're imaging God in our taking care of creation. So fruitful and multiplying isn't just about dispersion and procreation. It's also about cultural labor, and also talking about, therefore, tilling the garden, work, the goodness of work. All of that is going to be included in the idea of stewardship. And of course, we're going to talk about the cultural mandate, a very neo-Calvinist concept later on as well.
Yeah, what to add to those really superb, thorough definitions? I think we could reduce all of that to say something like stewardship is what you do with what you've got, what you've been given. J.H. Baving's way of thinking about it is that we have to consider the life that you have, it is a gift, but it's also a gift to be used. That's a responsibility. And the life that you have is rooted in the agency that you've been given as well, which ties into some of the things that Gray was talking about, with being made in the image of God, with the kind of metaphysical aspects of this. So life in that sense, as a responsibility to be active. And I mean, I think in Kuiper's own terms, we can start to think about some of the ways that he talks about Calvinism as producing people who are people of relentless activity. I know that we later on in the discussion, maybe we can talk about what it means to be active and when you need to be passive in your stewardship. But God made you to be a doer.
Okay, so just to pick up on that, the Greek term that we have in the New Testament for stewardship, oikonomos, gets applied to different people at different times in the New Testament. In Ephesians 1:10, oikonomos is used to describe God and the way God has mapped out redemptive history. So it uses the concept of stewardship, you know, typically translated plan, God's plan, his stewardship unto the fullness of time, which is to unite all things in Christ, heaven and earth, right? So Bavinck, others, we make a big deal of Ephesians 1:10 and the headship of Christ in this holy union of heaven and earth. So image of God, we are stewards. Can we talk about God's stewardship of time, God's stewardship of redemptive history, God's stewardship of the land? In what sense is image of God a participation category within God's own work across space and time unto the eschaton? How do you guys think about that?
Well, the immediate thing comes to my mind is, you know, in the Reformed tradition, we've got three sub-definitions of the doctrine of providence. First is that God governs the world, God preserves the world, and the third category is this idea of concurrence, that God is a primary cause that doesn't eliminate but establish creaturely secondary causes. You get this language of Westminster Confession of Faith 3:1, for instance. So I think we can say that it is a participation with the work of God. So when we say that God is moving along redemptive history, how does he do that? He's doing that through the sending of the prophets and the apostles. He's doing that by the work of the ministry of the church in the New Covenant context through ministry and sacrament, word and sacrament specifically. And also, I think there has to be something, you know, when we're redeemed and renewed by Jesus Christ, by the Spirit of Jesus Christ, and we're now laboring in ways that are obedient to his lordship, we have to say something about how we are therefore renewed image bearers. We're now imaging God the way that we were originally supposed to image God. If grace restores nature, and image bearers are supposed to reflect God in some way, not just with respect to our priestly calling, but also to our kingly and prophetic callings, then we have to say that Christ's renewing work means that we can now image him in a proper way as the church grows up, you know, goes out into the world as an organic church. Again, more to say, I'm very tempted to just jump the gun to the cultural mandate idea.
Almost, Gray.
Almost, yes, but I keep referring to it now, so go ahead. Yeah.
I think it's something that something interesting to plug into this. I think this, so what we, what's the thread through the conversation, I think that's how important creation is for this whole idea of stewardship. And I just had a brief conversation about that term. So how is it that the term stewardship, like rentmeesterschap in the Dutch word, doesn't really occur in the neo-Calvinist sources, but comes back later. For example, Bob Goudswaard, who's working in the neo-Calvinist tradition, he uses the word, and he goes back to Calvin, where he does find the word. And I'm not a Calvin scholar, so I'm afraid to say stuff like that. But somebody may comment on that later on. But I find this beautiful quote in his commentary on Genesis, where he does make this link between the concept of stewardship very broadly and creation. And here's what I want to give you. The earth was given to man with this condition that he should occupy himself in its cultivation. Let everyone regard himself as the steward of God in all things which he possesses. Then will he neither conduct himself dissolutely nor corrupt by abuse those things which God requires to be preserved. So it is very broad, I think, the way, very close to how you just described it, right? Just generally as, okay, so how do we treat, how do we deal with what is given to us by God, and also see it as such, as something that we have received and is our responsibility.
Yeah, I think in that sense, I mean, Neo-Calvinism gives us some resources to think about stewardship and the broadness of what you were just talking about there from Calvin, that actually stewardship is as broad as an individual human being's relationship to the entirety of the cosmos, because within that cosmos, God creates you as a conscious being, conscious in neo-Calvinistic terms of self, that you are you, that you know that you exist, in that sense, precognitively, grace, touching grace scholarship there. And so you have consciousness of self, of the world beyond yourself, and of God. But those forms of consciousness are, in the kind of terms that Gray talks about in his work, are precognitive forms of knowing. But consciousness of self, world, and God then are the basis by which you step forward towards self-knowledge as opposed to mere self-consciousness, and knowledge of the world as opposed to mere consciousness that there is a world beyond myself or within which myself exists, and knowledge of God as opposed to a mere consciousness of God. And as you step forward into all of those things, you're actually a steward in the sense of using your agency, of existing as a human. You're not just a stone or a pebble in the world, but you're a distinct kind of creature. And that's a gift, but it's also a responsibility. And it really does stretch out wherever you go in the cosmos. So we can think about it in such capacious terms. Although also then you can narrow it down in very fine-grained terms to my stewardship in lots of small parts of life, but they all make up the whole.
So there's this idea, right, that each individual personality has a particular direction or tendency, and that tendency manifests itself in the sorts of works that we might be attracted to. And Bonfink and Kuiper really emphasize this idea that the creation of humanity and the mandate in Genesis 1:26-28 presupposes, implies a kind of telos for the whole world, right? Adam in the garden and original humanity was supposed to disperse throughout creation, and each person, each community would reflect something of the image of God and God's glory as they disperse and create new communities, new cultures, and really cultural diversity. And that includes, of course, work diversity and the sorts of works that we have. And so I think ingredient in the neo-Calvinist tradition is a recognition of not only the goodness of labor, but the goodness of the diversities of labor. And in fact, Bavinck would argue that in that work, you also see a kind of heavenly trajectory. It is precisely by obeying God that we cultivate virtues of truth-seeking, virtues of original righteousness, to use that Reformed scholastic term. And that original righteousness is a precondition for us to actually be good stewards of God's creation, or else we're going to end up idolizing ourselves. And if we're idolizing ourselves, we're going to end up using creation for our own ends rather than actually, you know, imaging God and cultivating creation in light of God's own law and in light of God's own character. So we can talk about some of those pitfalls later on as well.
Yeah, I also wonder, just while you're saying that, that maybe the word stewardship would have just been a little bit too passive. for someone like Kuiper. And you're thinking like, okay, that stewardship does is not enough, right? It has a little bit of conserving also, like just only keeping what is there instead of really taking it and developing it and making it something different and new. I think that whole idea of progress and development, maybe not progress, depends on how you define it, but at least some development of what like God has created it with the purpose of it being like evolved by human beings, right? And then stewardship is maybe just a little bit too bleak.
So cultivation, right? Bill Edgar uses the language of analogous power. And, you know, coming with from the idea that the image of God means they were archetypal creations of God's archetype, right? So different ways to talk about that. But again, perhaps it's important to note that when we talk about dominion representing God, that stewardship and cultivation is always under the lordship of God and therefore not for our own ends. And so what Tyrion would say is that this original righteousness is, again, necessary to actually do this well. So work is not just deemed good, but now that this side of the fall is the case, we need to be renewed. We need to now be serving God and be under the church, the discipleship of the church, for us to actually labor well and properly.
So it does emphasize that aspect of it, right? The notion of stewardship. But that's important, I think, yeah.
So stewardship and cultural mandate work, oftentimes, I think one pitfall could be in the neo-Calvinist tradition is just for us to baptize those things and bypass the work of the church. Well, we need to see those two things as organically going together.
Yeah. Yeah, in redemption that we have in Christ, there is a reimagining and a reconstitution of the royal, prophetic, and priestly call that is constitutive of the image by which we steward. It's through this that threefold aspect of the image. Okay, let me take it. We'll take it. We've already done this, but we've already started. Yeah, so we'll take it where it's going. What are the theological concepts for you guys that are unique to the Neo-Calvinist tradition that give us a distinct account of the concept of stewardship? So we've mentioned cultural mandate. I think we want to sit on that for a minute. I'll mention another example just to get us started. So a creation theology that involves the concept of organism is important, right? Because in a world that is organic, we recognize the metaphysics of the universe and cosmos to include development, to include growth, and that includes us, right? And so the concept of stewardship requires a theology of organism, we might say, something to develop, something to grow, something to see grow unto a specific end, as you were mentioning, Gray. What else?
Well, I can chip in one other thing on organism as well. But if you have that in your theological field of vision, it helps you think about the things that you are called to, that you are trying to steward in your own sphere of life. Let's say in non-absolute, non-competitive terms, with the things that everyone else is called to conserve, or, you know, I have blinkers on with the one thing that I'm trying to steward and everything else could just fall apart. I don't care. As long as I steward my one tiny little patch of earth well, a way of thinking about the world in its organic unity, and Herman Bavinck is terrific on this, means the way that you steward has to be organically interconnected with the bigger picture of God's creation, of God's work in history.
I'll add one more, and immediately, therefore, go into the fires of controversy with my friend here to the left on Klaus Schilder, which is the idea of common grace. I think that common grace is necessary. That's probably a bit of an inside joke too much. Schilder doesn't like common grace, and we'll talk about that. But common grace, I think, is really necessary for idea of stewardship, especially, again, this side of the fall, because it makes sense of how it is that we can steward the earth, steward our work in ways that come alongside non-believers. And, you know, I was in a Faith and Work colloquium in RTS Orlando just a month or so ago, and I was trying to think about how to communicate the importance of common grace for the Faith and Work community. And I think what I came down to and through that conversation was that common grace allows us to be distinctively Christian, to be not ashamed of our Christian confession, even while we're working in the world, right? Such that, Kuiper argues, common grace is what allows us to give an account of the uniqueness of the Christian faith, even when non-believers seem to be better at their work, seem to be more virtuous than Christians, seem to be more good than Christians are. And so how do we not become disillusioned when we're going to the workplace and actually recognize that non-believers oftentimes are a lot better at a lot of what they do over Christians. And Common Grace gives a theological account of what they're doing. And so what I want to suggest, and I'm really curious to hear what you think about this, Marinus, is Common Grace is a precondition to how we might understand how we can implement and obey the cultural mandate in the context of the workplace when we have to come alongside the non-believer.
Yeah, well, you're pushing me to say this again, but it's okay. What Schilder's concern is with Common Grace, and it connects very well, I think, to the idea of stewardship, is that what he would say is that the idea of Common Grace, and maybe even also the idea of organism, make us downplay the importance of the cultural mandate, right? And also this of us realizing that we have a responsibility, we have a duty, we have a vocation to work, to do something, right? So that's why he makes that move, because we've talked over this many times, more than like really saying that the idea behind Common Grace is a bad idea, which I think he doesn't. It's more that it's just not what he wants to emphasize, because what he saw is that when that is emphasized, it downplays the importance and the necessity of that cultural mandate and a stewardship of obedience. That's a favorite word by Schilder. He uses a lot, right? So if God's grace is already working everywhere, then the need of Christians to do something is just lessened, right? That's his concern. And that's why he says, okay, rather than talking about common grace when we're talking about theology and culture, when we're talking about stewardship also, we should talk about a cultural mandate, because then we will not forget that we have a vocation, right? That it depends on what we do, because we are God's co-workers, 1 Corinthians 3, important text for Schilder. Then we are constantly reminded of that, right? So I think it's not a deep disagreement in that sense, but more like, how does it work? How does it play out? And with regard to organism also, that's a question for you guys. I mean, an organism grows by itself, right? I remember Kuiper saying of the church also that we have the institute and the organism. So the organism is that what is organically there, worked by the spirits in life. And the institute is what we built. It's the temporary scaffolding built by humans. So is organism the good word when we talk about stewardship and cultural mandate?
I think so, because organic life grows according to a particular pattern that's sort of preset within like the seed form of the organism. And in that regard, to be a steward of organic growth actually helps you start to think through the balance in Christian stewardship between activity and passivity, between the things that you need to do and the points where, as a good steward, you actually have to let the pattern of creation do what it's meant to do. But if you're a steward of organic growth, you can also, there can be important points of stewarding what is there to prevent bad growth, for example. The organic life can sort of metastasize and go wrong within itself as well. But I think there's something that's really good in the metaphor in the first place, and I think actually the point that you two were making there about Common Grace and Schilder's critique of it, that's also another application of stewardship, and that theologians are called to be good stewards of doctrine, good stewards of the intellectual tradition of the church, called to test out ideas well together and to love the Lord with our minds. So that's also an aspect of stewardship. One thing that I'm struck by when I think about the Neo-Calvinist tradition and distinctive resources that it gives, particularly when we get into the 20th century in Western cultural history, Neo-Calvinism, I think, is really at the forefront of Christian engagement with modern psychology. And in particular, I think J.H. Bavinck excelled in this regard. So in this conversation, we're here by proxy. I'm J.H. Bavinck, Herman Bavinck, Bas Schilder. Who are you, Corey?
Schleiermacher.
He's Schleiermacher in the corner. I am. So for J.H. Bavinck, he was right at the forefront of engagement with figures like Carl Jung, Sigmund Freud, who were pioneering all kinds of new developments in psychoanalytic thought and psychology and so on. And something that, J.H. Bavinck pushed back against in his context when he was pioneering Christian psychology as a neo-Calvinist was an idea that's still very common today, really common in North America. It's popular in the UK as well. And that's the idea that your personality type is fixed and it's set, you know, that you are an INBD or whatever. And you embark on this voyage of self-discovery to learn what you are like, and that won't change. So instead, the idea of stewardship, if we're going to apply that there, is more like a stewardship of the environs that I put myself in. If it's an environment that doesn't suit my fixed personality type, then it's not going to be good for me, so I'll put myself somewhere else. And you work out how to adapt the world rather than adapt yourself. And that's rooted in Carl Jung his psychology. J.H. Bavinck rejected that idea that personality, once you discover what your personality is like and how you're distinctively wired, that's just fixed forever. He thought that that's almost like an implicit heresy if you're a Christian for theological anthropology, because the Christian faith is predicated on the notion that you can change. And that's why the gospel comes and tells you to repent, which is an about turn in your life. And the gospel requires you to recognize that, yes, you're wired in a particular way, but the power of grace is such that it wires you differently and you can change. And I think when you look at the way that J.H. Bavinck develops that within a very neo-Calvinistic framework, what he gives us is a sense of the calling to both to be a personality, like there is a person that you are, you can discover that. But he also says very explicitly that through the gospel, you are called to become a personality. And what he means by that is actually that you're, like every one of us is distinctly wrongly wired because of the effects of sin, but the gospel will distinctly rewire each of us to be, whenever I say this, it sounds like I'm doing a bad Joe Lucian impression, but to be the best version of yourself. That's actually what the gospel gives you when grace restores nature, restores you and your particularity. And for J.H. Bavinck, I think what that means in effect, he doesn't use the term stewardship because of, you know, what Marinus was saying in terms of how this the term fits in the tradition. But in effect, what he says is that you are called to be a steward of your own personality, not just to be a passive recipient of, you know, that I'm just wired in this particular way and this is my personality type and that'll never change. In fact, the first place that stewardship begins is in your own inner life. And it's his big personality and worldview, which I think is a really masterful account of how to learn yourself in terms of who you're like as the starting point, why you're like that, and how to practice a kind of self-analysis of how your culture formed you, its narratives formed you, your parents, your upbringing, your schooling, all those things, and then understand how the gospel comes and shakes a lot of that up, and then will make you a different version of yourself, a better version of yourself. But I think that is a kind of stewardship, actually. And again, if we go back to what we were saying at the very beginning, where stewardship is all of our activity to the entirety of God's cosmos, and also towards God as our creator and redeemer. You have to think of stewardship in, I think, primordially like personal terms like that, that it's stewardship is really just me being me, if I understand my calling to be a human coram Deo, and therefore to love God and love neighbor. And where that puts us in very vast terms at the very beginning. But maybe that, I think that's probably quite helpful, because a lot of the time when Christians talk about this, it's very granular.
Yeah, so Schilder, when Schilder talks about cultural mandate, the first thing he says is it's self-cultivation. That's where it starts. So that connects very much to what J.H. Bavinck is
saying. Yeah, very much so.
And then the second step is like going out and doing your work in your daily job, daily work. But self-cultivation is the first cultural mandate for human. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that J.H. Bavinck would be against personality tests. And secondly, that J.H. Bavinck would be against this sort of, you know, we're thinking about cultivation, stewardship. One of the topics that we've talked about is technology and the virtual worlds that we live in. He would be very concerned about the sort of dual personality that we put out there, right? So there's the personality we have online, on Twitter or X, whatever. And then there's personality in real life, so to speak, right? So any comments on that, perhaps?
Yeah, so stewardship of social media presence. Obviously, he didn't deal with that because he was writing in 1927 or so. But it's a major challenge in our day, definitely, the way that having an online persona can mean that who you are as a personality is really fragmented. And that's probably quite poor stewardship of multiple things as well, poor stewardship of the domain of your presence there.
I think back to what you guys were saying a minute ago, it's important to say that common grace is not first something that we point to in the world. Common grace is first a reference to God's love and God's patience with us as sinners. And when we say that, I think Gray, earlier you were speaking towards this in reference to Skilder's critique. If we define it that way, common grace is the precondition, the reality that makes possible stewardship, particularly in the non-Christian domain, right? So how does one obey cultural mandate? How does one live quorum Deo? And particularly, you know, how does God continue to care for the world through broad humanity? And I think what, you know, one of the, maybe some of the pushback might be just to say that without common grace, what is the precondition of that possibility to live out the cultural mandate in a fallen cosmos? I think that would be the question that would arise.
I think he would just agree with what you said now, okay. But he just used different terms for it. We could go into that, but it's for another time.
Yeah.
You say that it's a light disagreement. When I read Skilder, it feels like a very heavy disagreement.
Yes, it does. It does.
The polemics, yeah. Definitely.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I understand. It looks like it's the worst heresy ever upon Christianity is common grace when you read, especially the later Skilder. But you have to read between the lines, and there is, and then it's really different. But yeah, I understand. Yes,
formally content, gray form and content.
That's right. Formally content.
Yeah. Well, you know, stewardship of form and content.
Yeah, that would be a lesson for Skilder.
Context is so important.
Context is very important. Yeah.
So go ahead.
I think Corey, you raised there a really big practical challenge with the idea of practicing Christian stewardship. That I guess is relevant to everyone who's here as well. So if you're thinking in a neo-Calvinistic framework, we don't inhabit a different world to people around us who are not Christians. We inhabit the same reality. There is only this world, which is God's world. And the objects that we are thinking about stewardship towards are common objects between ourselves and non-Christians. So there's this big challenge then of how do you think through what does it mean to steward a common object with your colleague who is an atheist, for example? So I'd love to know how each of you thinks about this. What does it mean to steward, I don't know, even time, and to be a good steward of your time, let's say in the workplace? You all have the same numbers of minutes and seconds each day as everyone else. But if you think about time in a fundamentally different framework, for example, also time quorum deo, what does that look like?
Yeah, that's a good, important question. I think one of the things to just say is that this is what touches on the prophetic aspect of the image of God, right? So when we come to faith in Christ, we are renewed and set apart. So I like Meredith Klein on this. He talks about how the prophetic aspect of the image or stewardship is to shine forth God's light into the world. And so in regeneration and in becoming a new creature, the prophetic calling is reimagined through Christ to where we might treat time differently to a colleague by pursuing the path of being a non-anxious presence, by pursuing the path of reconstituting productivity in the light of serving the glory of God rather than the profit line. Now, at the same time, I think it's important to say in this discussion that because of common grace, anybody can steward objects in creation well because of God's kindness and patience with the world and the gifts that he pours out on humanity. So I think that you've got to do both sides of that, right? What else?
Well, I think when you understand the Christian faith and you understand that Christianity provides a kind of metaphysics that tells you that, again, the person that you're relating with in the non-Christian context is still made in the image of God, is still exposed to God's general revelation and common grace. And therefore, I think one of the ways in which we can steward time and steward our presence within the non-Christian context is actually treating them with charity. Because Christianity resists this idea that it's us versus them, because we're all in the same boat. We're all sinners. None of us are any better than anybody else. And so therefore, we resist this false binary thinking that the other side is always the problem. Sin is the problem. And if the problem is not creational, but in sin, and sin is not a creational, you know, entity or substance, and the gospel is truly a universal call and the gospel could save anyone, I think we can be a very reconciliatory, peacemaking presence as well.
Yeah, and then that reminds us too of just the fact that that word stewardship in Paul's letters is most often focused on the gospel. You know, so one of the aspects of a distinction in stewardship for a Christian is that we have been called to steward the message of reconciliation. That's the precise language that Paul uses. He identifies himself in that way. He says, my office is to steward the gospel. And so that's another important aspect that probably needs to be thought through and discussed in relation to how that relates to how we steward the common objects of life as well.
So let's be explicit about pitfalls here. I think we already warned against some of them. You know, we're talking about the gospel, we're talking about the church, we're talking about faithfulness as Christians for the workplace, things like that. What are some pitfalls when we're talking about stewardship, cultural mandate, those sorts of issues from the neo-Calvinist tradition?
Yeah, well, one thing that comes to mind, I mean, if you, in the context where I'm in the Netherlands, at least, and I think also here, when you use the word stewardship, people immediately also think of the ecological crisis. I think of that word, like, how are we stewards of the creation that we have, that has been given to us? And maybe, probably we appear to be pretty bad stewards of that, as it turned out. And I'm also thinking of this major article by Lynn White in the 70s or 60s, like the historical roots of our ecological crisis, where she makes this connection between Christianity and the ecological crisis. And there's, of course, a lot you can say about that and to criticize also in what she says. But I think it shows that in that idea, what's also very present in neo-Calvinism of like development and progress and cultural mandate and like developing creation further, that there's also risks there when you use that concept. And maybe the ecological crisis shows some of those risks, like maybe too much optimism in how we do it, maybe an over-realized eschatology sometimes. So, and of course, it's hard to blame people like Kuiper and Bavinck for that because they lived in a very different time. But when you read that now, there's so much language of progress and development, and Kuiper explicitly points to what's coming in the 19th and the 20th century and how much better it has become compared to earlier centuries. And if you look at that from the present, you sometimes think, well, maybe it hasn't all become better. And he was very open to that. Let's be clear. He was deeply eschatological for Kuiper always. So he didn't believe in some linear progress. There's everywhere, and it's in Common Grace, it's in Pro Rega. There's always this realization that it's eschatological and it will probably go turn badly and go very differently. And it's not some kind of imminent progress idea in Kuiper. It's always like God who gives and gives not, and he's it's about the kingship of Christ, right? Pro Rega. So I think we can't blame Kuiper for having an overrealized eschatology. But if you read that now with those eyes after where we are, you sometimes have second thoughts, at least. What do you think?
Yeah, I agreed on the overrealized eschatology as a big potential pitfall. I think that being called to be a steward of things and called to that by God puts you in a really particular, almost like a dual category of what you're made to do as a creature. At one level, it's really exhilarating. It's honoring that you're being given things, good things by God, and given this position of stewardship. But at the same time, you're a steward and not the proper owner in that regard. And there's some kind of balance of holding those two things together that in itself just creates pitfalls on either side, I guess. I think the eschatological one is probably a common pitfall that, within neo-Calvinism. Something I really appreciated in the book that Corey and Gray wrote, The Theological Introduction to Neo-Calvinism, was a reminder of how eschatology worked for Herman Bavinck and for Kuiper, that you're called in life to cultivate good things, knowing that they point forward to a consummation of all things, where new things will come and will be better forever in ways that we can't even imagine, that surpass all our imagination. The fact that there will be new things that God will inaugurate doesn't mean that we become indifferent to, apathetic towards the things that we work at in this life. It also cushions the blow for the imperfection of those things and the imperfection of our own efforts as well. So it requires you to care deeply about the things you're called to do every day, and be motivated towards them. but also not to treat them as final things, and therefore not to be an idolater, I guess. I mean, that's the thing that the gospel saves us from anyway, but there's some way that that has to be applied within eschatology so that we don't over-realize it in the first place.
I think part of the pitfall is also in making like Genesis 1 so central in that notion of cultural mandate, where the central word is have dominion over. And of course, it depends on how you explain it and how you use that and take it. But that word has potential for problems, right? For having it like a dominating, like making humans way too important and given too much space in the whole of creation. So while there's like in Genesis 2, there is also the work and keep, right? So there's this, and there's the till the garden. So there's need those elements in balance, but there's, yeah, a potential risk in that word also.
One of the ways in which Bovink, I think, predicts one of the pitfalls of cultural mandate talk, cultural development talk, stewardship talk, is actually the ways in which he foresaw the coming of German nationalism and chauvinism in the context of the 20th century. So even in 1908, he was already making observations, reading British eugenics scientists, reading people like Houston Chamberlain, who was actually very influential in the Nazi movement later on. And he was basically showing that one of the ways in which this movement has gone awry is a kind of immanentization of the eschaton that sees one culture as the developed culture that's bringing about that utopian vision and other cultures as lagging behind. And so what the German colonialists and German nationalists at the time, as they were, you know, visiting other contexts, they were not seeing cultural diversity as such. It was almost like they were thinking of themselves as going back in a time capsule or time traveling period. They're looking at these other contexts and they were saying, these were how people were in the past, even though it's actually in the present day, right? And that our own nation is the most developed, these other nations were lagging behind. And so we got to help them develop, or we got to destroy them, or we got to, you know, basically spread the German culture precisely so that the rest of the world will be as developed as we are, so that the whole world can usher in this new immanentized eschaton. And Bovink argued, actually, that if you are a Christian, you believe that the eschaton is not going to come wrought by human labor, but by God alone. And if God is a source of normativity, not any immanent human culture, then how dare we use our culture as if it's the barometer or the yardstick as a standard to evaluate other cultures. And so what he actually argued was that given the Christian point of view, the end of history is not a linear advancement from this age to the next age, but rather the end of history is going to come through divine power alone. And the center of history is not in the present age. The center of history already happened 2,000 years ago in Jesus Christ. And so when we're talking about cultural development, we can't talk about it as if our cultural labor is that which will bring about the end times today,
right,
or the final kingdom today. But rather we have to somehow witness to it, and each culture will witness to it in their own way. And so we have to talk about cultural plurality and pluriformity as part of the plan of God.
Yeah, Bob's.
Thank you. No, go ahead. Last comments.
Yeah. No, so this is exactly this, what you just said is your reading guide to Schilder, right? I mean, if you want to understand why he's so opposed to it, it's because Bovink saw the beginnings of National Socialism. Schilder was right in the middle of it. Mm. He saw it happening all around. So that's why he warns against it. And he's so for him, this is one of his early books. He says that like the cultural mandate may very well mean concretely that you have to go out and be in the streets of the great city, but that you are there and you will be killed, right?
Yeah.
So that's not optimism. That's not construction or building. It can mean being a martyr. Yeah, it's pretty grim, but that's the image you use.
Yeah, we got to learn those last lessons. And right. And Bovink and Schilder are definitely better than Kuiper on these issues.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Okay, James. Anything? Last comment.
Oh, well, we spent a lot of the discussion talking in big picture terms and in major doctrines, and that's been deliberate on our part, just to try and start off the conversation across the whole of this conference. But I think it would be really interesting to end with each of us listing one granular issue, an issue where you think about stewardship and its application. And again, maybe where Neo-Calvinism is useful. So not an extended description of it, but just a prompt for us to I'll think about stewardship in specific ways. What are you assured of?
Yeah, you know, I think of the cultural mandate as just an implication of who we are as made in God's image, and that hopefully that helps people demystify it. Because when we tell to the normal, you know, Christian layperson on the pew, like, obey the cultural mandate, and they're like, wait a minute, I thought I was supposed to obey the so-called Great Commission. What is this cultural mandate thing? And I think what the Neo-Calvinist, you know, tradition helps us to see is that this cultural mandate is just to be human. Like, if you are being human properly, you are obeying the cultural mandate. If you're taking care of yourself, you're following virtues, you're trying to cultivate yourself, your personality, your own workplace. So I think the Neo-Calvinist tradition helps you be human without feeling guilty for it.
Preach. I love it. Marinus.
Yeah, so I was on the way in the train of being reading through Kuiper in Pro Rega on society, and I was struck by how what he said, and I thought like that's also helpful in this discussion, how he said that, like, so he has this section on the family, on the state, on the church, on the individual, and then society, he says, is the most difficult part, and as in our vocation as a Christian, because there are no structures there. It's like an open space where nobody controls it, really, right? The government is controlled, and in the church there's some kind of control, and the family also, but not in society. And I think that is really spot on also for my own context. I'm also a pastor in a church in Amsterdam, and in like helping the people and also myself, and how do you... How do we engage that society? How are we present there? And how does it relate being there in our Christian organizations? Like, do I send my kids to a Christian school? That's a big debate in our church among parents, because well, if as Kuiper says, society is one. Right, there's the churches, there's a separation, in the government also we have the different parties, but the society as a whole, like as Christians and non-Christians, you're all together, but if you organize yourself in different schools, there's also a separation, what Kuiper favors, obviously, but that's like an example. So I think that the challenge of Kuiper to think about, okay, so the society is one, how are you a steward in that space? And also the realization that it's not an easy place to do that. Maybe the most difficult one. It was supposed to be short.
Why don't you go, then I'll turn to the audience.
Yeah, so I think something that I try to steward deliberately is languages in their plurality. Something I love about the Neo-Calvinist tradition, if you think about it in the big context of Christian history, is that it's an unusually positive tradition for theological reasons towards human language diversity, which I think all goes back to a doctrine of creation and cultural mandate and so on. So since we're all quoting J.H. Bavinck, he said that when you encounter a language, you encounter that culture's greatest achievement. And that's what you find in a language. So I think it's an amazing way to think about distinct languages, that they are distinct achievements of those cultures. And there's a lot to be stewarded there. I think that in different languages, they enable us to see the same reality, but in slightly different ways. And I think that is so across the human race, as the image of God, for the glory of God. And something is lost when the human race becomes less linguistically diverse, but to keep it diverse in that way takes a lot of intentional stewardship. So part of I'm an elder in a bilingual Spanish-English congregation in Edinburgh, and that's a very intentional kind of stewardship even within the life of the church, to have the glory of God explored and expressed together in two languages, although there are lots of people who speak other languages in our church as well. And Neo-Calvinism is quite an amazing resource for a church like mine.
Good. I'll just add that one thing we haven't talked about that came to my mind throughout is how important it is maybe to talk beyond this about the category of love, that love is the gatekeeper of all right stewardship. 1 Corinthians 12 and 13, the way to use your gifts into the world has to walk through the domain of love, love of God and love of neighbor.